Mr. Gaunt held out his hand. Ace began to reach for it, and then saw there was already something in it. It was the brown rat from the trap in the storeroom. Ace pulled back with a little grunt of disgust. He hadn't the slightest idea when Mr. Gaunt had picked up the dead rat. Or perhaps it was a different one? Ace decided he didn't care, one way or another. All he knew was that he had no plans to shake hands with the dead rat, no matter how cool a dude Mr. Gaunt was. Smiling, Mr. Gaunt said, "Excuse me, every year I grow a little more forgetful. I believe I just tried to give you my dinner, Ace."
"Dinner,"
Ace said in a faint little voice.
"Yes, indeed." A thick yellow thumbnail plunged into the white fur which covered the rat's belly. A moment later, its intestines were oozing into Mr. Gaunt's unmarked palm. Before Ace could see more, Mr. Gaunt had turned away and was pulling the alley door closed.
"Now, where did I put that cheese?"
There was a heavy metallic snick as the lock engaged. Ace leaned over, sure he was going to vomit between his shoes. His stomach clenched, his gorge rose, and then sank back again. Because he hadn't seen what he thought he'd seen. "It was a joke," he muttered. "He had a rubber rat in his coat pocket or something. It was just a joke."
"Was it?
What about the intestines, then? And the cold, jelly-like mung which had surrounded them? What about that?"
"You're just tired," he thought. "You imagined it, that's all. It was a rubber rat. As for the rest, poof." But for a moment, everything, the deserted garage, the self-directed Tucker, even that ominous piece of graffiti, Yog Sothoth Rules, tried to cram in on him, and a powerful voice yelled, "Get out of here! Get out while there's still time!" But that was the really crazy thought. There was money waiting for him out there in the night. Maybe a lot of it. Maybe a son-of-a-bitching fortune. Ace stood in the darkness for a few minutes, like a robot with a flat power pack. Little by little, some sense of reality, some sense of himself, returned, and he decided the rat didn't matter. Neither did the Tucker talisman. The blow mattered, and the map mattered, and he had an idea that Mr. Gaunt's very simple business policy mattered, but nothing else. He couldn't let anything else matter. He walked down the alley and around the corner to the front of Needful Things. The shop was closed and dark, like all the shops on Lower Main Street. A Chevy Celebrity was parked in one of the slant spaces in front of Mr. Gaunt's shop, just as promised. Ace tried to remember if it had been there when he arrived with the talisman and really couldn't do it. Every time he tried to cast his mind back to any memories before the last few minutes, it ran into a roadblock. He saw himself moving to accept Mr. Gaunt's offered hand, most natural thing in the world, and suddenly realizing that Mr. Gaunt was holding a large, dead rat. "I believe I'll have a bite to eat. I'd ask you to join me, but..." Well, it was just something else that didn't matter. The Chevy was here now, and that was all that did. Ace opened the door, put the book with the precious map inside it on the seat, then pulled the keys out of the ignition. He went around to the back of the car and opened the trunk. He had a good idea of what he would find, and he wasn't disappointed. A pick and a short-handled spade were neatly crossed over each other in an X. Ace looked more closely and saw Mr. Gaunt had even put in a pair of heavy work gloves. "Mr. Gaunt, you think of everything," he said, and slammed the trunk. As he did, he saw there was a sticker on the Celebrity's rear bumper, and he bent closer to read it. "I love antiques." Ace began to laugh. He was still laughing as he drove across the tin bridge and headed toward the old Treblehorn place, which he intended to make the site of his first dig. As he drove up Panderley's Hill on the other side of the bridge, he passed a convertible headed in the other direction, toward town. The convertible was filled with young men. They were singing, "What a Friend We Have in Jesus," at the top of their voices, in perfect one-part Baptist harmony. One of those young men was Lester Ivanhoe Pratt. Following the touch football game, he and a bunch of the guys had driven up to Lake Auburn, about 25 miles away. There was a week-long tent revival going on up there, and Vic Tremaine had said there would be a special 5 o'clock Columbus Day prayer meeting and hymn sing. Since Sally had Lester's car and they'd made no plans for the evening, no movie, no dinner out at McDonald's in South Paris, he'd gone along with Vic and the other guys, good Christian fellows, every one. He knew, of course, why the other guys were so eager to make the trip, and the reason wasn't religion. Not entirely religion, anyway. There were always lots of pretty girls at the tent revivals which crisscrossed northern New England between May and the last state fair Oxpull at the end of October, and a good hymn sing, not to mention a mess of hot preaching and a dose of that old-time Jesus spirit, always put them in a merry, eager mood. Lester, who had a girl, looked upon the plans and schemes of his friends with the indulgence an old married man might show for the antics of a bunch of young bucks. He went along mostly to be friendly, and because he always liked to listen to some good preaching and do some singing after an exhilarating afternoon of head-knocking and body-blocking. It was the best way of cooling down, he knew. It had been a good meeting, but an awful lot of people had wanted to be saved at the end of it. As a result, it had gone on a little longer than Lester would have wished. He had been planning to call Sally and ask her if she wanted to go out to Weeksy's for an ice cream soda or something. Girls like to do things like that on the spur of the moment sometimes, he had noticed. They crossed the tin bridge, and Vic led him out on the corner of Main and Laurel. "Great game, Les," Bill McFarland called from the back seat. "Sure was," Lester called back cheerily. "Let's do it again Saturday. Maybe I can break your arm instead of just spraining it." The four young men in Vic's car roared heartily at this piece of wit, and then Vic drove away. The sound of "Jesus is a friend forever" drifted back on air, which was still strangely summery. You expected a chill to creep into it, even during the warmest spells of Indian summer weather after the sun went down. Not tonight, though. Lester walked slowly up the hill toward home, feeling tired and sore and utterly contented. Every day was a fine day when you'd given your heart to Jesus, but some days were finer than others. This had been one of the finest kind, and all he wanted right now was to shower up, call Sally, and then jump into bed. He was looking up at the stars, trying to make out the constellation Orion when he turned into his driveway. As a result, he ran balls first and at a brisk walking pace into the rear of his Mustang. "Oof!" Lester Pratt cried. He backed up, bent over, and clasped his wounded testicles. After a few moments, he managed to raise his head and look at his car through eyes which were watering with pain. What the heck was his car doing here anyway? Sally's Honda wasn't supposed to be out of the shop until at least Wednesday, probably Thursday or Friday, with the holiday and all. Then, in a burst of bright pink-orange light, it came to him. Sally was inside. She had come over while he was out, and now she was waiting for him. Maybe she had decided that tonight was the night. Premarital sex was wrong, of course, but sometimes you had to break a few eggs in order to make an omelet, and he was certainly up to the task of atoning for that particular sin if she was. "Rudy toot toot," cried Lester Pratt enthusiastically. "Sweet little Sally in her birthday suit." He ran for the porch in a crabby little strut, still clutching his throbbing balls. Now, however, they were throbbing with anticipation as well as pain. He took the key from beneath the doormat and let himself in. "Sally," he called. "Sal, are you here? Sorry I'm late. I went over to the Lake Auburn revival meeting with some of the guys and..." He trailed off. There was no response, and that meant she wasn't here after all. Unless... He hurried upstairs as fast as he could, suddenly sure he would find her asleep in his bed. She would open her eyes and sit up, the sheet falling away from her lovely breasts, which he had felt, well, sort of, but never actually seen. She would hold her arms out to him, those lovely, sleepy, cornflower blue eyes opening wide, and by the time the clock struck 10, they would be virgins no longer. Rudy toot! But the bedroom was as empty as the kitchen and the living room had been. The sheets and blankets were on the floor, as they almost always were. Lester was one of those fellows so full of energy and the Holy Spirit that he could not simply sit up and get out of bed in the morning. He bounded up, eager not just to meet the day, but to blitz it, knock it to the greensward, and force it to cough up the ball. Now, however, he walked downstairs with a frown creasing his wide, ingenuous face. The car was here, but Sally wasn't. What did that mean? He didn't know, but he didn't much like it. He flipped on the porch light and went out to look in the car. Maybe she had left him a note. He got as far as the head of the porch steps, then froze. There was a note, all right. It had been written across the Mustang's windshield in hot pink spray paint, probably from his own garage. The big capital letters glared at him. "Go to hell, you cheating bastard!" Lester stood on the top porch step for a long time, reading this message from his fiancée over and over and over again. The prayer meeting? Was that it? Did she think he'd gone over to the prayer meeting in Lake Auburn to meet some floozy? In his distress, it was the only idea that made any sense to him at all. He went inside and called Sally's house. He let the phone ring 24 times, but no one answered. Sally knew he would call, and so she had asked Irene Lutjens if she could spend the night at Irene's place. Irene, all but bursting with curiosity, said yes, sure, of course. Sally was so distressed about something that she hardly looked pretty at all. Irene could hardly believe it, but it was true. For her own part, Sally had no intention of telling Irene or anyone else what had happened. It was too awful, too shameful. She would carry it with her to her grave. So she refused to answer Irene's questions for over half an hour. Then the whole story came pouring out of her in a hot flood of tears. Irene held her and listened, her eyes growing big and round. "That's all right," Irene crooned, rocking Sally in her arms. "That's all right, Sally. Jesus loves you even if that son of a bitch doesn't. So do I. So does the Reverend Rose. And you certainly gave the muscle-bound creep something to remember you by, didn't you?" Sally nodded, sniffling, and the other girl stroked her hair and made soothing sounds. Irene could hardly wait until tomorrow, when she could start calling her other girlfriends. They wouldn't believe it. Irene felt sorry for Sally. She really did, but she was also sort of glad this had happened. Sally was so pretty, and Sally was so darned holy. It was sort of nice to see her crash and burn just this once. And Lester's the best-looking guy in church. If he and Sally really do break up, I wonder if he might not ask me out. He looks at me sometimes like he's wondering what kind of underwear I've got on, so I guess it's not impossible.
"I feel so horrible," Sally wept. "So dirty."
"Of course you do," Irene said, continuing to rock her and stroke her hair. "You don't still have the letter and that picture, do you?"
"I burned them," Sally cried
loudly against Irene's damp bosom, and then a fresh storm of grief and loss carried her away.
"Of course you did," Irene murmured. "It's just what you should have done."
"Still," she thought, "you could have waited until I had at least one look, you wimpy thing." Sally spent the night in Irene's guest room, but she hardly slept at all. Her weeping passed eventually, and she spent most of that night staring dry-eyed into the dark, gripped by those dark and bitterly satisfying fantasies of revenge, which only a jilted and previously complacent lover can fully entertain. Mr. Gaunt's first, by appointment only, customer arrived promptly at 8 o'clock on Tuesday morning. This was Lucille Dunham, one of the waitresses at Nan's Luncheonette. Lucille had been struck by a deep, hopeless aching at the sight of the black pearls in one of the display cases of Needful Things. She knew she could never hope to buy such an expensive item, never in a million years, not on the salary that skinflint Nan Roberts paid her. All the same, when Mr. Gaunt suggested that they talk about it without half the town leaning over their shoulders, so to speak, Lucille had leaped at the offer the way a hungry fish might leap at a sparkling lure. She left Needful Things at 8:20, an expression of dazed, dreaming happiness on her face. She had purchased the black pearls for the unbelievable price of $38.50. She had also promised to play a little prank, perfectly harmless, on that stuffed-shirt Baptist minister, William Rose. That wouldn't be work, as far as Lucille was concerned. It would be pure pleasure. The Bible-quoting stinker had never once left her a tip, not even so much as one thin dime. Lucille, a good Methodist who didn't in the slightest mind shaking her tail to a hot boogie beat on Saturday night, had heard of storing up your reward in heaven. She wondered if the Reverend Rose had heard that it was more blessed to give than to receive. Well, she would pay him back a little, and it was really quite harmless. Mr. Gaunt had told her so. That gentleman watched her go with a pleasant smile on his face. He had an extremely busy day planned, extremely busy, with appointments every half hour or so and lots of telephone calls to make. The carnival was well established. One major attraction had been tested successfully. The time to start up all the rides at once was now near at hand. As always, when he reached this point, whether in Lebanon, Ankara, the western provinces of Canada, or right here in Hicksville, USA, he felt there were just not enough hours in the day. Yet one bent every effort toward one's goal, for busy hands were happy hands, and to strive was in itself noble and, And if his old eyes did not deceive him, the day's second customer, Yvette Gendron, was hurrying up the sidewalk toward the canopy right now. "Busy, busy, busy day," Mr. Gaunt murmured, and fixed a large, welcoming smile on his face. Alan Pangborn arrived at his own office at 8:30, and there was already a message slip taped to the side of his phone. Henry Payton of the state police had called at 7:45. He wanted Alan to return the call ASAP. Alan settled into his chair, placed the telephone between his ear and his shoulder, and hit the button which auto-dialed the Oxford Barracks. From the top drawer of his desk, he took $4 silver. "Hello, Alan," Henry said. "I'm afraid I've got some bad news about your double murder." "Oh, so all at once it's my double murder," Alan said. He closed his fist around the four cartwheels, squeezed, and opened his hand again. Now there were three. He leaned back in his chair and cocked his feet up on his desk. "It really must be bad news. You don't sound surprised." "Nope." He squeezed his fist shut again and used his pinky finger to force the lowest silver dollar in the stack. This was an operation of some delicacy, but Alan was more than equal to the challenge. The silver dollar slipped from his fist and tumbled down his sleeve. There was a quiet chink sound as it struck the first one, a sound that would be covered by the magician's patter in an actual performance. Alan opened his hand again, and now there were only two cartwheels. "Maybe you wouldn't mind telling me why not," Henry said. He sounded slightly testy. "Well, I've spent most of the last 2 days thinking about it," Alan said. Even this was an understatement. From the moment on Sunday afternoon when he had first seen that Nettie Cobb was one of the two women lying dead at the foot of the stop sign, he had thought of little else. He even dreamed about it, and the feeling that all the numbers added up short had become a nagging certainty. This made Henry's call not an annoyance, but a relief, and saved Alan the trouble of calling him. He squeezed the $2 silver in his hand. Chink opened his hand. Now there was one. "What bothers you?" Henry asked. "Everything," Alan said flatly, starting with the fact that it happened at all. "I suppose the thing that itches the worst is the way the timetable of the crime works, or doesn't work. I keep trying to see Nettie Cobb finding her dog dead and then sitting down to write all those notes. And do you know what? I keep not being able to do it. And every time I can't do it, I wonder how much of this stupid goddamn business I'm not seeing." Alan squeezed his fist viciously shut, opened it, and then there were none. "Uh-huh. So maybe my bad news is your good news. Someone else was involved, Alan. We don't know who killed the Cobb woman's dog, but we can be almost positive that it wasn't Wilma Jurczyk." Alan's feet came off the desk in a hurry. The cartwheels slid out of his sleeve and hit the top of his desk in a little silver runnel. One of them came down on edge and rolled for the side of the desk. Alan's hand flicked out, spooky quick, and snatched it back before it could get away. "I think you better tell me what you got, Henry." "Uh-huh. Let's start with the dog. The body was turned over to John Palin, a DVM in South Portland. He is to animals what Henry Ryan is to people. He says that because the corkscrew penetrated the dog's heart and it died almost instantly, he can give us a fairly restricted time of death." "That's a nice change," Alan said. He was thinking of those Agatha Christie novels which Annie had read by the dozen. In those, it seemed there was always some doddering village doctor who was more than willing to set the time of death as between 4:30 p.m. and 5:15. After almost 20 years as a law enforcement officer, Alan knew a more realistic response to the time of death question was sometime last week, maybe. "It is, isn't it? Anyway, this Dr. Palin says the dog died between 10 o'clock and noon. Peter Jurczyk says that when he came into the master bedroom to get ready for church, at a little past 10, his wife was in the shower." "Yes, we knew it was tight," Alan said. He was a little disappointed. "But this guy Palin must allow for a margin of error, unless he's God. 15 minutes is all it takes to make Wilma look good for it." "Yeah? How good does she look to you, Alan?" He considered the question, then said heavily, "To tell the truth, old buddy, she doesn't look that good. She never did." Alan forced himself to add, "Just the same, we'd look pretty silly keeping this case open on the basis of some dog doctor's report and a gap of, what, 15 minutes? "Okay, let's talk about the note on the corkscrew. You remember the note? 'Nobody slings mud at my clean sheets. I told you I'd get you.' The very one. The handwriting expert in Augusta is still mooning over it, but Peter Jerzyk provided us with a sample of his wife's handwriting, and I've got Xerox copies of both the note and the sample on the desk in front of me. They don't match. No way do they match. The hell you say. The hell I don't. I thought you were the guy who wasn't surprised. I knew something was wrong, but it's been those rocks with the notes on them that I haven't been able to get out of my mind. The time sequence is screwy, and that's made me uncomfortable, yeah, but on the whole, I guess I was willing to sit still for it, mostly because it seems like such a Wilma Jerzyk thing to do. You're sure she didn't disguise her handwriting? He didn't believe it. The idea of traveling incognito had never been Wilma Jerzyk's style, but it was a possibility that had to be covered. Me? I'm positive, but I'm not the expert, and what I think won't stand up in court. That's why the notes and graph analysis. When will the handwriting guy file his report? Who knows? Meantime, take my word for it, Alan. They're apples and oranges, nothing alike. Well, if Wilma didn't do it, someone sure wanted Nettie to believe she did. Who? And why? Why, for God's sake? I don't know, Scout. It's your town. In the meantime, I have two more things for you. Shoot. Alan put the silver dollars back into his drawer, then made a tall, skinny man in a top hat walk across the wall. On the return trip, the top hat became a cane. Whoever killed the dog left a set of bloody fingerprints on the inner knob of Nettie's front door. That's big number one. Hot damn! Warm damn at best, I'm afraid. They're blurry. The perp probably left them grasping the doorknob to go out. No good at all? We've got some fragments that might be useful, although there isn't much chance that they'd stand up in court. I've sent them to FBI Print Magic in Virginia. They're doing some pretty amazing reconstructive work on partials these days. They're slower than cold molasses. It'll probably be a week or even 10 days before I hear back. But in the meantime, I compared the partials with the Jerzyk woman's prints, which were delivered to me by the ever-thoughtful medical examiner's office last evening. No match? Well, it's like the handwriting, Alan. It's comparing partials to totals, and if I testified in court on something like that, the defense would chew me a new asshole. But since we're sitting at the bullshit table, so to speak, no, they're nothing alike. There's the question of size, for one thing. Wilma Jerzyk had small hands. The partials came from someone with big hands. Even when you allow for the blurring, they are damn big hands. A man's prints? I'm sure of it. But again, it'd never stand up in court. Who gives a fuck? On the wall, a shadow lighthouse suddenly appeared, then turned into a pyramid. The pyramid opened like a flower and became a goose flying through the sunshine. Alan tried to see the face of the man, not Wilma Jerzyk, but some man, who had gone into Nettie's house after Nettie had left on Sunday morning. The man who had killed Nettie's raider with a corkscrew and then framed Wilma for it. He looked for a face and saw nothing but smoke and shadows. Henry? Who would even want to do something like this, if it wasn't Wilma? I don't know, but I think we might have a witness to the rock-throwing incident. What? Who? I said might, remember. I know what you said. Don't tease me. Who is it? A kid. The woman who lives next door to the Jerzyks heard noises and came out to try and see what was going on. She said she thought maybe that bitch, her words, had finally gotten mad enough at her husband to throw him out a window. She saw the kid pedaling away from the house, looking scared. She asked him what was going on. He said he thought maybe Mr. and Mrs. Jerzyk were having a fight. Well, that was what she thought, too, and since the noises had stopped by then, she didn't think any more about it. That must have been Jillian and Miss Liberski, Alan said. The house on the other side of the Jerzyk place is empty, up for sale. Yeah, Jillian and Miss Lewatsky, that's what I got here. Who is the kid? Dunno. She recognized him, but couldn't come up with a name. She says he's from the neighborhood, though, probably from right there on the block. We'll find him. How old? She said between 11 and 14. Henry, be a pal and let me find him. Would you do that? Yep, Henry said at once, and Alan relaxed. I don't understand why we have to roll these investigations when the crime happens right in the county seat anyway. They let them fry their own fish in Portland and Bangor, so why not in Castle Rock? Christ, I wasn't even sure how to pronounce that woman's name until you said it out loud. There are a lot of poles in Castle Rock, Alan said absently. He tore a pink traffic warning form from the pad on his desk and jotted Jill Miss Liberski and Boy 11 to 14 on the back. If my guys find this kid, he's going to see 3 big state troops and be so scared everything goes out of his head, Henry said. He probably knows you. Don't you go around and talk at the schools?
Yes, about the DARE program and on Law and Safety Day, Alan said. He was trying to think of families with kids on the block where the Jerzyks and the Miss Laburskys lived. If Jill Miss Laburski recognized him but didn't know his name, that probably meant the kid lived around the corner, or maybe on Pond Street. Alan wrote three names quickly on the sheet of scrap paper: DeLois, Rusk, Bellingham. There were probably other families with boys in the right age group that he couldn't remember right off the bat, but those three would do for a start. A quick canvas would almost certainly turn the kid up.
Did Jill know what time she heard the ruckus and saw the boy? Alan asked.
She's not sure, but she thinks it was after 11. So it wasn't the Jerzyks fighting, because the Jerzyks were at Mass.
Right.
Then it was the rock thrower.
Right again.
This one's real weird, Henry.
That's three in a row. One more and you win the toaster oven.
I wonder if the kid saw who it was.
Ordinarily, I'd say too good to be true, but the Miss Laburski woman said he looked scared, so maybe he did. If he did see the perp, I'll bet you a shot and a beer it wasn't Nettie Cobb. I think somebody played them off against each other, Scout, and maybe just for the kick of the thing. Just for that.
But Alan, who knew the town better than Henry ever would, found this fantastical.
Maybe the kid did it himself, he said. Maybe that's why he looked scared. Maybe what we've got here is a simple case of vandalism.
In a world where there's a Michael Jackson and an asshole like Axl Rose, anything's possible, I suppose, Henry said. But I'd like the possibility of vandalism a lot better if the kid was 16 or 17, you know?
Yes, Alan said.
And why speculate at all, if you can find the kid? You can, can't you?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
But I'd like to wait until school lets out, if that's okay with you. It's like you said, scaring him won't do any good.
Fine by me. The two ladies aren't going anywhere but into the ground. The reporters are around here, but they're only a nuisance. I swat them like flies.
Alan looked out the window in time to see a news van from WMTW-TV go cruising slowly past, probably bound for the main courthouse entrance around the corner.
Yeah, they're here too, he said.
Can you call me by 5?
By 4, Alan said. Thanks, Henry.
Don't mention it, Henry Payton said, and hung up.
Alan's first impulse was to go get Norris Ridgwick and tell him all about this. Norris made a hell of a good sounding board, if nothing else. Then he remembered that Norris was probably parked in the middle of Castle Lake with his new fishing rod in his hand. He made a few more shadow animals on the wall, then got up. He felt restless, oddly uneasy. It wouldn't hurt to cruise around the block where the murders had taken place. He might remember a few more families with kids in the right age brackets if he actually looked at the houses. And who knew? Maybe what Henry had said about kids also held true for middle-aged Polish ladies who bought their clothes at Lane Bryant. Jill Miss Laburski's memory might improve if the questions were coming from someone with a familiar face. He started to grab his uniform hat off the top of the coat tree by the door, and then left it where it was. It might be better today, he decided, if I only look semi-official. As far as that goes, it wouldn't kill me to take the station wagon. He left the office and stood in the bullpen for a moment, bemused. John LaPointe had turned his desk and the space around it into something that looked in need of Red Cross flood relief. Papers were stacked up everywhere. The drawers were nested inside each other, making a tower of Babel on John's desk blotter. It looked ready to fall over at any second. And John, ordinarily the most cheerful of police officers, was red-faced and cursing.
"I'm going to wash your mouth out with soap, Johnny," Alan said, grinning.
John jumped, then turned around. He answered Alan with a grin of his own, one which was both shame-faced and distracted.
"Sorry, Alan, I..."
Then Alan was moving. He crossed the room with the same liquid, silent speed that had so struck Polly Chalmers on Friday evening. John LaPointe's mouth fell open. Then, from the corner of his eye, he saw what Alan was up to. The two drawers on top of the stack he had made were starting to tumble. Alan was fast enough to avert an utter disaster, but not fast enough to catch the first drawer. It landed on his feet, scattering papers, paper clips, and loose bunches of staples everywhere. He pinned the other two against the side of John's desk with his palms.
"Holy Jesus, that was lickety-split, Alan," John exclaimed.
"Thank you, John," Alan said with a pained smile. The drawers were starting to slip. Pushing harder did no good. It only made the desk start to move. Also, his toes hurt.
"Toss all the compliments you want, by all means. But in between, maybe you could take the goddamn drawer off my feet."
"Oh, Shit! Right! Right! John hurried to do it. In his eagerness to remove the drawer, he bumped Alan. Alan lost his tenuous pressure hold on the two drawers he had caught in time. They also landed on his feet.
Ouch!
Alan yelled. He started to grab his right foot and then decided the left one hurt worse.
Bastard!
Holy Jesus, Alan, I'm sorry.
What have you got in there?
Alan asked, hopping away with his left foot in his hand.
Half of Castle Land Quarry?
I guess it has been a while since I cleaned him out. John smiled guiltily and began stuffing papers and office supplies helter-skelter back into the drawers. His conventionally handsome face was flaming scarlet. He was on his knees, and when he pivoted to get the paper clips and staples which had gone under Klutz's desk, he kicked over a tall stack of forms and reports that he had stacked on the floor. Now the bullpen area of the sheriff's office was beginning to resemble a tornado zone.
Whoops!
John said.
Whoops!
Alan said, sitting on Norris Ridgewick's desk and trying to massage his toes through his heavy black police-issue shoes.
Whoops is good, John. A very accurate description of the situation. This is a whoops if I ever saw one.
Sorry, John said again, and actually wormed under his desk on his stomach, sweeping errant clips and staples toward him with the sides of his hands. Alan was not sure if he should laugh or cry. John's feet were wagging back and forth as he moved his hands, spreading the papers on the floor widely and evenly.
John, get out of there!
Alan yelled. He was trying hard not to laugh, but he could tell already it was going to be a lost cause. LaPointe jerked. His head bonked briskly against the underside of his desk, and another stack of papers, one which had been deposited on the very edge of gravity to make room for the drawers, fell over the side. Most flumped straight to the floor, but dozens went seesawing lazily back and forth through the air. He's going to be filing those all day, Alan thought resignedly, maybe all week. Then he could hold on no longer. He threw back his head and bellowed laughter. Andy Clutterbuck, who had been in the dispatcher's office, came out to see what was going on. Sheriff, he asked, everything okay?
Yeah, Alan said.
Then he looked at the reports and forms scattered hell to breakfast and began to laugh again.
John's doing a little creative paperwork here, that's all.
John crawled out from under his desk and stood up. He looked like a man who wishes mightily that someone would ask him to stand at attention or maybe hit the deck and do 40 push-ups. The front of his previously immaculate uniform was covered with dust, and in spite of his amusement, Alan made a mental note. It had been a long time since Eddie Warburton had taken care of the floor under these bullpen desks. Then he began laughing again. There was simply no help for it. Klutz looked from John to Alan, and then back to John again, puzzled.
Okay, Alan said, getting himself under control at last. What were you looking for, John? The Holy Grail? The lost cord? What?
My wallet, John said, brushing ineffectually at the front of his uniform. I can't find my goddamn wallet.
But did you check your car?
Both of them, John said. He passed a disgusted glance over the asteroid belt of junk around his desk. The cruiser I was driving last night and my Pontiac. But sometimes when I'm here, I stick it in a desk drawer because it makes a lump against my ass when I sit down. So I was checking.
It wouldn't bust your ass like that if you didn't keep your whole goddamn life in there, John,
Andy Clutterbuck said reasonably.
Clut, Alan said. Go play in the traffic, would you?
Huh?
Alan rolled his eyes.
Go find something to do. I think John and I can handle this. We're trained investigators. If it turns out we can't, we'll let you know.
Oh, sure. Just trying to help, you know. I've seen his wallet. It looks like he's got the whole Library of Congress in there. In fact,
thanks for your input, Klutz. We'll see you.
Okay, Klutz said. Always glad to help. Later, dudes.
Alan rolled his eyes. He felt like laughing again, but controlled himself. It was clear from John's unhappy expression that it was no joke to him. He was embarrassed, but that was only part of it. Alan had lost a wallet or two in his time, and he knew what a shitty feeling it was. Losing the money in it and the hassle of reporting credit cards gone west was only part of it, and not necessarily the worst part, either. You kept remembering stuff you had tucked away in there, stuff that might seem like junk to someone else, but was irreplaceable to you. John was hunkered down on his hams, picking up papers, sorting them, stacking them, and looking disconsolate. Alan helped.
Did you really hurt your toes, Alan?
Nah, you know these shoes. It's like wearing Brinks trucks on your feet. How much was in the wallet, John? No more than 20 bucks, I guess. But I got my hunting license last week, and that was in there. Also my MasterCard. I'll have to call the bank and tell them to cancel the number if I can't find the damned wallet. But what I really want are the pictures. Mom and Dad, my sisters, you know, stuff like that. But it wasn't the picture of his mother and father, or the ones of his sisters, that John really cared about. The really important one was the picture of him and Sally Ratcliffe. Clutt had taken it at the Freiburg State Fair about 3 months before Sally had broken up with John in favor of that stone brain, Lester Pratt. Well, Alan said, it'll turn up. The money and the plastic may be gone, but the wallet and the pictures will probably come home, John. They usually do. You know that. Yeah, John said with a sigh. It's just that, damn, I keep trying to remember if I had it this morning when I came to work. I just can't. Well, I hope you find it. Stick a lost notice up on the bulletin board, why don't you? I will. And I'll get the rest of this mess cleaned up. I know you will, John. Take it easy. Alan went out to the parking lot, shaking his head. The silver bell tinkled. Sonny Jacket came into Needful Things slowly, warily, kneading his grease-stained Sunoco cap in his hands. His manner was that of a man who sincerely believes he will soon break many expensive things, no matter how much he doesn't want to. Breaking things, his face proclaimed, was not his desire, but his karma. Mr. Jacket! Leland Gaunt cried his customary welcome with his customary vigor, and then made another tiny check mark on the sheet beside the cash register. So glad you could stop by. Sonny advanced 3 steps further into the room and then stopped, glancing warily from the glass cases to Mr. Gaunt. Well, he said, I didn't come in to buy nothing. Got to put you straight on that. Old Harry Samuels said you asked if I'd stop by this morning if I had a chance. Said you had a socket wrench set that was some nice. I've been looking for one, but this ain't no store for the likes of me. I'm just making my manners to you, sir. Well, I appreciate your honesty, Mr. Gaunt said, but you don't want to speak too soon, Mr. Jacket. This is one nice set of sockets, double measure adjustable. Oh, yeah? Sonny raised his eyebrows. He knew there were such things which made it possible to work on both foreign and domestic cars with the same socket wrenches, but he had never actually seen such a rig. That so? Yes, I put them in the back room, Mr. Jacket, as soon as I heard you were looking. Otherwise, they would have gone almost at once, and I wanted you to at least see them before I sold the set to someone else. Sonny Jacket reacted to this with instant Yankee suspicion. Now, why would you want to do that? Because I have a classic car, and classic cars need frequent repairs. I've been told you're the best mechanic this side of Derry. Oh, Sonny relaxed. Mayhap I am. What have you got for wheels? A tucker. Sonny's eyebrows shot up, and he looked at Mr. Gaunt with a new respect. A torpedo. Fancy that. No, I have a talisman. Yeah? Never heard of a Tucker talisman. There were only 2 built, the prototype and mine. In 1953, that was. Mr. Tucker moved to Brazil not long after, where he died. Mr. Gaunt smiled mistily. Preston was a sweet fellow and a wizard when it came to auto design, but he was no businessman. That so? Yes. The mist in Mr. Gaunt's eyes cleared. But that's yesterday, and this is today. Turn the page, eh, Mr. Jacket? Turn the page, I always say. Face front, march cheerily into the future, and never look back. Sonny regarded Mr. Gaunt from the corners of his eyes with some unease and said nothing. Let me show you the socket wrenches. Sonny didn't agree at once. Instead, he looked doubtfully at the contents of the glass cases again. Can't afford nothing too nice. Got bills a mile high. Sometimes I think I ought to get right the hell out of business and go on the county. I know what you mean, Mr. Gaunt said. It's the damned Republicans. That's what I think. Sonny's knotted, distrustful face relaxed all at once. You're goddamned right about that, chummy, he exclaimed. George Bush has damn near ruined this country, him and his goddamn war. But do you think the Democrats have anyone to put up against him next year who can win? Doubtful, Mr. Gaunt said. Jesse Jackson, for instance, a nigger. He looked truculently at Mr. Gaunt, who inclined his head slightly as if to say, Yes, my friend, speak your mind. We are both men of the world who are not afraid to call a spade a spade. Sonny Jacket relaxed a little more, less self-conscious about the grease on his hands now, more at home. I got nothing against niggers, you understand, but the idea of a jig in the White House, The White House gives me the shivers.
Of course it does, Mr. Gaunt agreed. And that wop from New York, Mario Cuomo. Do you think a guy with a name like that can beat that four-eyed dink in the White House?
No, Mr. Gaunt said. He held up his right hand, the long first finger placed about a quarter of an inch from his spatulate ugly thumb. Besides, I mistrust men with tiny heads.
Sonny gaped for a moment, then slapped his knee and gasped wheezy laughter.
Mistrust men with tiny... Say, that's pretty good, mister. That's pretty goddamn good.
Mr. Gaunt was grinning. They grinned at each other.
Mr. Gaunt got the set of socket wrenches, which came in a leather case lined with black velvet, the most beautiful set of chrome steel alloy socket wrenches Sonny Jacket had ever seen. They grinned over the socket wrenches, baring their teeth like monkeys that will soon fight. And, of course, Sonny bought the set. The price was amazingly low, $170, plus a couple of really amusing tricks to be played on Don Hemphill and the Reverend Rose. Sonny told Mr. Gaunt it would be a pleasure. He would enjoy stinking up those psalm-singing Republican sons of whores' lives. They grinned over the trick to be played on Steamboat Willie and Don Hemphill. Sonny Jacket and Leland Gaunt, just a couple of grinning men of the world. And over the door, the little silver bell jingled. Henry Beaufort, owner and operator of the Mellow Tiger, lived in a house about a quarter of a mile from his place of business. Myra Evans parked in the Tiger's parking lot, empty now in the hot, unseasonable morning sunshine, and walked to the house. Considering the nature of her errand, this seemed a reasonable precaution. She needn't have worried. The Tiger didn't close until 1 in the a.m., and Henry rarely rose much before that same hour in the p.m.